So, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our session, the Cloud OS for Databases. We're just going to kick off with a little bit of an introduction. My name's James Crawshaw. I work for Microsoft, based out of Sydney. I'm a technical specialist in the infrastructure space, so the data center technology, system center, Windows Server, Azure, and the virtualization platform. And I'm joined by my colleague, Shashank.
Hi, thanks, James. I'm Shashank Pawar. Data platform specialist, so I live above the stack on where he sets up things. But we're here working better together to show you what's possible.
Always working better together. So, interestingly, this year, the Cloud OS for Databases, there was a lot, you've seen a lot around the Cloud OS. You've heard a lot about the new database technologies that are coming along. We thought we'd do a sort of a merge of a session. So you may see some content that you've seen elsewhere. However, what we're trying to do is bring the two together for this conversation. As far as the objectives for today, first off, we're going to give you some understanding of how this private cloud thing is going to work for you from a SQL perspective. What have we got to offer you technologies in that space? The intention is to arm you guys, arm DBAs, with infrastructure knowledge. We want to make sure you understand that side of things. That said, we appreciate that you won't necessarily care about the infrastructure. You want to be able to get a database from running, use it, have self-service and all that sort of stuff. But we want to give you that knowledge as well. This is, you know, improving database admin and database productivity. It's all about making sure that we can add value to the business. If there are businesses that want to innovate, they need to be able to stand up projects and get them running very quickly. And there's been a lot of success stories over the last 18 months, 24 months around being able to enable that. And I think the last point, Shash.
Yeah, we figured there's a bit of an election weekend coming up. We thought, you know, if you vote for us number 5 on the evals, we'll hold some promises and give away things.
Yeah. So that's our objective, to be fair.
Actually, the first question I'm going to throw out there is, how would you like us to do the giveaways? You know, normally say you guys ask us interesting questions and then we'll throw stuff at you. We got some really cool stuff, by the way. Those are a few of gamers, Xbox Live, 12-month subscription. A nice Arc mouse.
There's a few of these things knocking around.
So come up with some any good ideas that you guys have. If not, we'll just be randomly throwing it out at you. Yeah. Just make sure you're awake.
No worries. Oh, there's someone looking for a catch over there. That'll come in a minute. Yeah, okay, no worries. Right, so that's the objective.
Oh, let's have practiced.
Blimey.
There you go.
So what have we heard is the next piece, right? So there you got our objectives. What have we heard over the course of the last year since the previous tech ed?
So, yeah, James, I go into many organizations, and one of the common things I hear is about database workloads not being able to be virtualized. Mm. And I know that that's pretty common. We, you know, last 2 to 3 years ago, I would have gone in and said that. But today, we're here to show you, you can absolutely virtualize database workloads. And of course, with my colleague standing next to me, best on Hyper-V.
Yeah.
And the next thing we commonly hear from here is chargeback. But more and more, when I peel that layer down, more and more, it's about understanding what are the database environments running in my organization. How can I do right allocation? It's more about understanding who's using what, so we can fairly allocate hardware and so forth. And then eventually, when we get to that entire cloud journey and have a true chargeback model that plugs into an existing billing model that you may have or may not have.
And just on the chargeback point, Shash, I think the important thing is, not everybody wants to do full-on chargeback. Some people just want to be able to show allocation and understand that certain projects use more than others, you know, so that from an admin perspective, you can see where your sort of top-level costs are and that sort of thing. So, you know, that's one of the things we want to be able to show how you can do that.
Absolutely. Then the next thing is, I mean, so all of this is available in the public cloud, but, I mean, not a lot of my customers, or I'm guessing you guys who are out in the audience, don't want to put your crown jewels, your data, the thing that runs in the heart of your company onto public cloud, especially now that we don't have a data center yet. I know it's announced and it's coming down in Australia. So how can we achieve this, this simplicity that Azure offers internally? That's the common thing. I wish I could run Azure internally. You know, is there a magic appliance or is there some sort of a machine that I can buy to make that happen?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, today's session is just about to show you that. So let's flick over to my demo machine, which is number 2. over here, and I'm going to just start creating a new database environment. I mean, we are all DBAs. Actually, just a quick poll of hand, show of hands. DBAs in the room? Infrastructure guys in the room?
Where are my people? Where are my people?
See, you're outnumbered here.
I would throw. You can come get. That's cool. There's loads.
So I'm going to start creating, while the infrastructure guy's busy giving away stuff, I'm going to start creating a database here. So come here, new database, quick create, and you know, let's get ticket 2013 rocks. All right, and hit create database.
Shash, you're in the wrong portal.
Oh, geez, you're right. We're in Windows Azure. Okay, sorry. I got it wrong. I am in the public cloud. Okay, I'm flicking over. Sorry, I've got too many tabs open.
There we go. That's the right portal.
There I am. I'm in the right portal.
Looks completely different right now.
I'm in the right portal, and I'm going to go ahead and create a new database, okay, just for you on your premise, on the infrastructure you built. And let's go ahead and do that. So let's give that ticket 2013 rocks. We'll go through and select editions that I've pre-created here. In this case, I've got some SQL Server 2014 CTP1 clusters out there, gold, silver, bronze. These are my different plans that I've got. I can go through and
using my different levels of infrastructure there, Shash. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Hyper-V man, thank you. I'll go ahead and make you an admin on this.
Thank you, yeah.
I don't know if I should trust infrastructure guys on databases, but there we go.
I don't know what I'm going to do
with it. As easy as that, this is on-premise being able to create a database, deploy a database, self-service. I'm logged into a similar experience as you. And now, we can also not only do as databases, you can see that we can also create MySQL databases. And the reason why our title of our session was Cloud OS for your databases was that you can do this for SQL, Oracle, MySQL, and these are customizable service provider frameworks. And not only that, of course, you can go through and deploy out infrastructure as a service in your environment. So virtual machines. So very, very quickly, just like I would in Azure. There we go. Standalone machine, and then from gallery. I have a pre-built list of gallery of VMs, and some of them, as you can see, this is a SQL audience, SQL Server sessions. They're all pre-configured with SQL Server. Now, you might be wondering, oh, this might be just a UI magic, and you know, you really haven't created a database. Well, let's go through and crack open Management Studio, where we all live in, right? So let's go and refresh that. I created my SQL Server 2014 on my gold cluster, which I'm connected to. Apologize for the fonts being a bit small. And there you go. That's my Ticket 2013 Rocks database deployed out for me.
Right,
it's as easy as that, guys. We will be going through that.
We're going to go into the detail.
For the questions. So we will definitely be pulling into that. So I'm just going to move back.
Fundamentally, we wanted to give you visibility to doing what you can do in Azure in the public cloud on-premise in the same Azure portal. And you can see, there you go. One of the things that Shash was able to do from the portal also was get the connection string out. So you can get the connection string, you can spin up a VM, go into the VM, stick his application on there, and plug the connection string in. All self-service. Okay? Fundamentally, that's it. We're kind of done. I'm guessing you came for a little
bit more than that.
Long lunch at the beach. Yeah, long lunch, right. I'm guessing you came for a little bit more than that. Fundamentally, though, that's the sort of top-level experience that we're trying to get across to you. Now, we're going to change gear here, because we know you want to go down into the depths of how some of those things work. So we're going to go through fundamentally some best practices. We're going to touch on Windows Azure Pack to start with, but then we're going to go back to how do we build that? You know, how do we actually put that in place so that we can have that experience in our environment? Okay. So, moving on. Consistent experience. Let me just give you a quick heads up about what's going on in this world. You guys have been to, I'm sure, and seen some of the Azure sessions this week. You've probably seen some things around websites, around service bus, virtual machines, service management portal, and so on. Fundamentally, consistent experience is what we're looking to provide here across the board. So we have, obviously, the Microsoft hosted platform Azure, where you just log on yourself, and Microsoft looks after all the infrastructure. And these four services, or four categories of services, are available there. Azure Pack enables us to put that sort of capability in the service provider world as well as in the on-premise world. So when I say that, what I'm getting at is websites, actual proper platform as a service capability. We have an IIS pool, Internet Information Services pool, that's spread across the infrastructure and managed by the service provider. People can go into that self-service portal and create a website and register into that pool. Okay, and then obviously plug into the SQL databases and so on. Highly scalable DevOps can be moved from shared, free to shared to dedicated instances if you need to. The service bus piece, again, the messaging platform that Windows Azure has in the public cloud, that IP, that capability is coming down or has come down on the 18th of October into the Azure Pack capabilities here as well. So being able to build that same capability. Virtual machines, Shash just showed you that. Fundamentally, that is the ability to do that infrastructure as a service capability, tenant-based, multi-tenant isolation between the different environments. You, sir, spin up some VMs in there. You spin up some VMs. You can use the same IPs, and they're still isolated and kept separate to each other, but built on-premise. The last piece is where the glue comes in. The APIs between the two are the same. So where you see a similar graphical interface when we switch between the two, that is fundamentally just plugging into the API. The APIs under the hood are actually the same between the two. So any investment and work that you do in interfacing with this environment through Windows Azure Pack can then be replicated in the public cloud from a management perspective. So what is it under the hood? Who's seen this slide? We got one. OK. So what I'm trying to get at with you here is on the left-hand side, we have what it is in our environment under the hood that Microsoft manage for you. It's the Windows Azure Fabric. All of this good stuff under the bottom here. And then all the services that we offer out up the top. Then the API on top of that to manage it, and then obviously the portal that we provide to you guys. In the Windows Azure Pack world, that's obviously slightly different from the point of view of you have to put it together yourself. Microsoft aren't doing it for you in that space. So if I look in the bottom right-hand corner, yes, we have workload portability between the two because fundamentally, Windows Server 2012 is the common platform underneath the hood. Hyper-V 2012 is the hypervisor in both spaces. System Center 2012 with the service provider framework, that effectively provides the service layer that we then build the services on top of. You've got your common management experience, as I mentioned before. You've got the ability to use a self-service portal in the same way as you would do for Azure. But if you look at what's missing, I suppose, on the left-hand side is that clearly, as Microsoft, there are certain services offered to you and given to you in a plan basis, right? So I'd write like a mobile phone tower, or I could write a plan at Microsoft, write a plan and offer it out over Windows Azure Public Service. That portal isn't exposed to the public. So we have to provide you with what we call a service provider portal so you can craft your own plans where you saw that Shash had ability to do MySQL databases, SQL databases, and VMs, but you can also add in the websites and those other capabilities and be granular about what you offer and what types of services, VMs you offer and things like that. So the cloud-enabled services are these. The future services cloud is an interesting one. What we're seeing over time, we understand, is that we're going to have a bit of a sort of synchronization of this capability. So there are some things on the left-hand side that are not on the right-hand side, and there are actually some granular features in here on the right-hand side that are not over in Windows Azure. And we're going to see over time a synchronization of that capability and that functionality. So moving off this piece, I think we probably get into the meat of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We thought we couldn't leave it with some pretty PowerPoints, could we? We had to actually convert that PowerPoint and believe in that story or run through that story ourselves. So, of course, we went into the server room, built ourselves a private cloud environment. There we are, even kneeling to the demo gods and putting the Fusion I.O. cards. Fusion I.O. cards, by the way, anybody using them? Awesome. Fantastic. If you're not, you should definitely go and see the guys at the booth, see what is possible. We'll be showcasing some of the capabilities. But this little baby here helped us build our environment in less than a day. Deploying VMs become really, really easy.
And these USBs, just so you know, these have got some of the Fusion I.O. documentation on them. You can pick them up from the booth, and we've got plenty here, so please come and collect them.
Yeah. In fact, one thing that I learned through this entire experience is when you're working with your infrastructure buddies, take them out to laksa lunches. They work best then. That was my key takeaway.
I do like a curry.
But let's see what was that little squiggly diagram. What was that?
That little squiggly diagram? Well, that little squiggly diagram there, That's a professional drawing. That's...
Oh, come on. We can do better than that.
So let's whiteboard what we actually built. What's the infrastructure under the hood? Okay. So from an infrastructure perspective, if I'm going to provide all these fancy services on the top end, there's some things I fundamentally have to do at the bottom end. I have to make my fabric well-managed and shareable. So I'm building effectively a obviously a Hyper-V platform, Hyper-V host platform. I'm also building a scale-out file server platform, the file services capability where I can junction in lots of different types of storage, or just use Windows Server with storage spaces, and join those together so that I can offer a fabric infrastructure that I can build on top of and build that multi-tenant platform on top of. So the next piece we do, once we've got a lot of that done, is that we define the logical networking in this environment. Now, this is a relatively complex concept because if you think about public cloud and Windows Azure, this is the stuff that's all managed for you. When you go in there and go new virtual network on Windows Azure, because you want to put a database and a server in there, there's a lot of work under the hood going on with network virtualization and logical network definitions and software-defined networking. So we have to define a lot of this. So we define logical switches, and they are things that we then layer over the top of our Hyper-V host platform, and they provide the logical networks. When I say logical, I work for Microsoft. When I go to the Sydney office, when I go to the Brisbane office, I want to attach onto the same logical network to access my resources. I might be a different subnet of those different locations. You know, it might physically be on a different subnet, but I get access to the same logical resources. So that's the next piece, the logical networks that we define. Then the last one is the virtual networks. That is the tenant networks. Those are the ones that sit on top of it, again, on top of that, that we define whatever it is we want to use. So once we've done that, then we can start carving out capacity. We can say, I want a cloud of this size to have this many gigabytes of RAM, this much storage, and this many CPUs, and so on. And then I use that to plug into the Azure pack. So that means that when we got to that stage, we've pretty much got everything we need. The last piece, and we haven't done this in our environment, is where you can actually plug into additional service provider capacity. So you can use the Azure pack to actually plug in and register capacity at third-party service providers and also hook into the Azure cloud as well.
So that might be for additional capacity reasons, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that piece where you've got the similar experience. You can start moving your services between those locations. So, I mean, that's the pretty version of the environment. It was similar. It's kind of the same. That's not too bad. I think we got there in the end.
Don't kid yourself.
We got there in the end.
Anyway, right then. So thank God we have some people at Co-op who can put this in good white papers. So we've actually just released the best practices for virtualizing and managing SQL Server. And it goes through each of these steps. And we're going to take a selection of the best practices here. We obviously have the link at the bottom for you to go through and read. It's about a 95-page document. We would have been here for a lot longer than the 75 minutes if we went through each of the details.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not about presenting the white paper. It's presenting the top-level pieces of it so that you guys have got some grounding in that space. So we're going to step into fabric management, then we'll go through those other pieces. So let's get started. Well, I will do if the clicker's going to do it for me. Okay, so fabric. What do we need in the fabric space? Well, first off, we need hardware that's capable of running our platform. So from a virtualization perspective, we need to be Intel AVT or AMDV, but equally now we need to ensure that we've got SLAT-enabled hardware, second-level address translation hardware. Now you're safe if you're buying latest generation processors. You don't need to be worrying about this sort of thing. But if you're looking at repurposing all the hardware or anything along those lines, these are important things to consider. In the storage world, there's some fantastic technology in Server 2012 that's enabling a consolidation of the way we manage storage. And this is how we get that scale in Azure, how we're able to offer these different services. So if you think about storage and server, storage spaces is the storage controller built into Windows Server now, the new storage controller in there. And that can leverage just a bunch of disks, JBOD arrays, to be able to pull that together and give you shared storage, highly available shared storage. SAN arrays that you might have, fiber channel, iSCSI, those sorts of things. What we can do with those, we can take them and we can plug them into something we call a scale-out file server. It's like the old school file server, except on steroids, effectively. This thing leverages SMB3, the file share protocol, to mean that we can scale out to 8 nodes in a scale-out file server with upwards of 50 to 100 gigabits worth of bandwidth into each node on that. And then we can offer our services off that.
I believe there's a question here, and we could have a first major giveaway if this isn't a good question.
Where's it coming from? I can't see. No, there's no question. There's no question for now.
Okay.
Okay.
Cool. Oh, damn. Nobody wants our giveaways.
So we'll go through that again in a little bit more detail. From a network perspective, from hardware, we should be using 10 gig E as a base. In the fabric world, absolutely. We're going to put as many tenants as we possibly can on top of this. We don't want to be having concerns here. So we're looking at multiple physical adapters per host. And in the Server 2012 world, we don't have to do things like teaming because we have things like multi-channel that mean that we're able to communicate from host to host, from database to database, Server 2012, and we'll just split the traffic flow across all of the available interfaces we have. So we break it up and get maximum throughput. If we lose an interface, we also have resiliency because any transaction that was flowing is actually transparently handled by the client-server protocol, and it will fail over to another node and replay transactions. So if that's a SQL database live running on one of these shares, it doesn't notice a single thing. It just continues to function as a node drops out. Nick teaming is fantastic that you can leverage, and it's good for certain services. It's even better when you're looking at previous OSs, 2003 and so on, because they don't have that SMB3 multi-channel capability, so you need to put some resilience in at Nick teaming level. Okay, so we're just going to have a quick look at what we call the fire-breathing dragon, the scale-out file server. Oh, hang on. Or have I just gone backwards? So I think I'm on 5, right, Shash?
These guys have to make mythical names for their demos to look good, huh? At the infrastructure level. But anyway, this is very cool once you see it.
Okay. So, first off, Server Manager. Who's seen Server Manager in 2012? Everybody, I should imagine. Okay. Who's seen Server Manager managing a load of servers in Server 2012? Okay, cool. What's great about it is the fact that it consolidates everything into one space. Now, the thing I care about that's got a big red flashing light on it is file and storage services, where I've built my scale-out file server. The reason it's got a big flashing light, if I drill into here, is because a certain person's been doing some heavy lifting on a CPU on a SQL server here. So you can see if I look in the properties, last night at what time was it, Shash? Half past midnight.
Yep. You've got the CPU, nothing like last minute demos.
You've got the
right?
CPU up to 90% for some reason. I don't know what you're doing at that time of night. CPU up to 90%. But anyway, that's given me some visibility there. That's not what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at is going into that specific role. When I go in there, I can see all my servers listed. What I want to do is go to shares. I'm going to go shares, and I've already got it filtered there on something called SOFS01. SOFS01 is just the name I created for the clustered instance of my scale-out file server. So that's a UNC path, fundamentally. And then these are the 5 shares that I have on there. Now, what's really important about this, and let me just show you what this looks like from a file share perspective, is fundamentally, I can just click through into these different share locations, and I can see the SQL data that's being run for one of the databases on here. Absolutely. But you can see by the names of them, you've got a Hyper-V tiered shared volume, which has got storage tiering enabled on, just using storage spaces, Windows Server, meaning hot blocks will move up into the SSD tiers. You've got a volume here that's shared called SAN Fiber Channel. You've got one called SAS Parity, it's just RAID 5 volume. All of this is consolidated into the back of the file server and then presented out over SMB with a different file share. Now, that's fantastic, but where the power comes from where we can allocate that to different types of plans in the Azure pack later on, and we'll get to that. You can see how people can subscribe to more expensive and less expensive plans. And I think this was an area where you found this quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. This made it easy for me to deploy out my SQL environments. Once James had finished out building the infrastructure, building out the scale-out file server, deploying SQL Server on top of this was very, very easy. All I needed to get was that UNC part. No longer did I have to worry about getting him to set the right RAID levels. Of course, he did that under the covers, but no, you know, I wasn't worried about how many LANs were presented out to my OS image and so on and so forth. It was just the file share. And SQL Server 2012 and 2014, and I support that. In fact, in 2014, with the cluster I built here, and James, are you going to click through?
Yeah, well, I was just going to quickly show is that you've got a SQL cluster here. And if I look at disks, there are no disks attached to this cluster at all.
There's no shared disk. Because we actually now have cluster shared volume as a way to present for SQL Server 2014 clustering, and that's fully supported. And you'll see now the data files actually sit on the scale-out file server as a UNC part. And I might answer your question that you had earlier.
So the interesting thing here is, and last year I did a session with one of Shashank's colleagues, Raja, where you see this UNC path, there are 2 nodes in this scale-out file server. When the SQL database goes and opens the connection to that database file to load it up, it's going to one of those nodes to get that handle. The session we did showed through PowerShell how you can actually automatically migrate the storage path that it's using to go through another file server. So you can do that through PowerShell. You can actually move the nodes around. So say if you want to do maintenance, it's not a failure situation. So it's a very flexible, powerful technology to... So
exactly. It happens behind the scene. So you will see this as we go through the journey of this session. We create service plans which align you to the different storage that you have.
So think about your mobile phone plan. When you buy different levels of mobile phone plan, you don't choose which greater carrier you're going to go on, but you get it because of the price sort of thing. So the plan offers that level of service to you. Okay, so that's a little bit of information around the scale out file server.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I'm just going to throw something.
There we go.
There you go. Good question.
Go for it. Yep, that's right. Yep. So that's an interesting question. Depending on the OS you're running in the guest, in the VM, obviously you have certain protocols available to you to be able to talk to file shares. So if you're running a Linux CentOS box and you want to be able to talk across to an SMB share, you're going to need to have an implementation of SMB on there to leverage the SMB share. Something we haven't implemented, but you can, is you can go into that file server cluster, and I'll just show you very quickly. I can't actually do it, but you can go into the file server cluster and you can see the shares we have here listed. If I go right-click and add file share, I can actually choose different types of file shares, and we can actually present NFS shares off the front of this cluster as well. And they could be offered through plans too. So from the point of view of the guest OS, the actual VM instance itself, CentOS, whatever it might be, there are alternatives that you can present across, and that's NFS 4.1 in that instance. The other side of that coin is the fact that actually, maybe the VM is running on top of a scale-out file share. It's not talking to it directly, so it's a Linux VM running in a Hyper-V bubble, and the VHDs are on that share, so the VM doesn't need to know anything about it at all. Does that answer your question? Sort of. Okay. Maybe it's something we can talk about later. Cool, no problem.
Well, just on that note, one of the things that we did with the Fusion I/O cards here as well is introduce the new tiering capability of Windows Server 2012 R2, which SQL was able to take advantage of. I don't know if you quickly
Yeah, that's
that
right. Point. I mean, look, we've got these different categories. We've got a Fusion I/O, so that's just local storage, and then we've got this tiered CSV, which is effectively we've got three disks in it. We've got a couple of 300 gig SAS disks in it, and also an SSD, which is a VHD that's running on that Fusion I/O card. So you can see how you can actually leverage the investment in those Fusion I/O type cards for performance there. Okay, let's skip back across, and I think it's two, Shash?
Seven.
Seven. Okay. So, moving into host resiliency and VM agility. And we'll get through this relatively quickly. We wanted to show you some best practices here. Clustering, so whether you're doing SQL clustering, file server clustering, Hyper-V clustering, anything you're using for clustering, you should be aware of the fact that there's now cluster-aware updating built in. So any resources that are running on that cluster, whether it's a SQL database, a Hyper-V VM, a file server node, those resources are migrated off active nodes. The node that they were on that was being serviced will be taken down and have the updates applied to it and then reinserted. But it's not just the patch system that's done there. We actually actively, dynamically alter the quorum configurations of the actual cluster itself. So the cluster stays resilient, stays highly available. From a storage perspective, we should always make sure that we optimize for random I/O. We dedicate disks to SQL under the hood. So in our environment, we're a bit sneaky for our demo. The cluster shared volume is actually supporting two shares. One's the Hyper-V share, one's the SQL share. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be keeping them separated.
This one's quite important because commonly I hear, this is where customers I speak to about virtualizing SQL Server. They go off and put SQL Server along with their file share virtualized environment or Exchange servers or web servers. And too often it shares the same storage environment as those other environments. And so SQL resources compete for that, and then you end up with poor performance. So, if you're creating a virtualized or SQL private cloud, do it on a dedicated hardware, do it in dedicated storage environment.
Yeah, definitely. And look, if you're going to be looking at hardware or talking to guys who are provisioning hardware for you, something else that's extremely important at the compute layer is to make sure that you get hardware with offered capabilities. Things like RSS, DCB, and RDMA. These capabilities are only in certain types of NICs, certain types of hardware, and you should make sure that you get those. Again, that white paper goes into all the detail on that, and a lot of the later cards will have that capability. Next point, VM affinity and availability sets. Just a note, make sure you take advantage of this. There's no point in building a cluster and leaving both cluster nodes to sit on the same physical server. Of course there's not, right? So anti-affinity, enable that, keep them separate. However, at the high level, from the point of view of Azure, for example, where you don't have visibility to hosts, there's a concept of availability sets, and that plays its way into Azure Pack as well. And you create an availability set, and you put your cluster in that, and that on its own ensures that that anti-affinity occurs. You don't have to worry about it going on under the hood. Okay. These features at the bottom are very important to us because these are the ultimate flexibility pieces. Live migration. You all know what that is. vMotion. Live migration, moving a memory state across and moving VMs around. The important piece is the next one, live storage migration, moving the VMs disks around behind the scenes that might contain, as we said before, a SQL database that you want to move up a tier to a different level of performance database. If you combine the two together, though, this is something that we released in 2012, which is shared nothing live migration, that ultimate flexibility for us to move a VM entirely transparently as to whether there's any shared storage or not, from one host to another host, just with a network cable. And that, at the time, was us first to market. Hello, sir.
Right, with the live storage migration, is that database complete, or can you do it at file?
So that's at the host level. So that's the actual VM and its VHDs that we're moving around.
Storage.
Yep.
Going from tier to tier.
Yep.
Certain parts of your database.
Yes. So what you can do, say you've got a CD and E drive in your VM. Those could be different VHDs under the hood, and you can pin certain volumes to the SSD tier, I suppose, yeah. If you want to guarantee it stays there. If that's what you're asking in the storage spaces world, yeah, absolutely. So that's another prize.
Once
for that
again, I believe there's a question at the back there.
There's one at the back. Great question. So when I showed you the file shares, one of the file shares is just called SSD FIO. That volume is presented out of a scale-out file server, but it's obviously just on a Fusion IO card that's in one box. Okay, so that would be something you'd use for TempDB or Scratch, or in fact, I don't want to say that. Perhaps you should say that.
That's fine. You're on the spot.
Or Scratch or so on. But yes, you're right. That's not going to be HA, that piece. Well, the migration process wouldn't be a problem. It's only if you physically lost that box and it burned and you couldn't get it back, right, that volume on SSD or Fusion IO goes. And look, the Fusion IO guys will talk to you about ways and means of making their storage available across multiple hosts. What we're doing is leveraging them as a high-performance piece for various different components of a fabric. We can offer it out in a plan. You know, for example, with Windows Azure, you get a D drive, and that D drive you don't keep when you if there is an issue with the VM, yeah. But it's high performance disk that you can leverage should you want to.
Or moving up the stack from a SQL perspective, you use SQL Server's capability for HA and DR, so always on, or SQL's clustering capabilities itself.
Yeah, absolutely. We're just offering those different menu options, I suppose, in there. Yes, sir. Oh, I see what you mean, and I'll let Shashank answer that one from an application level perspective.
So your question was more about, you know, if from a SQL perspective, if you just run the things on single node. Yeah, so, I mean, virtualization will give you level of protection from the host perspective, but not at the SQL server level, right? So you want to have HA at the SQL database level because the application sees the database, and if the database isn't available, your application's down. So you want to have either in-guest clustering or always on or some form of replication technology to allow you to, if the SQL fails, SQL itself, the service fails, it comes up on other environments. The other thing is also there's Hyper-V has its own capability, which we are about to cover in shortly in a slide, but Hyper-V replica. So if you don't have, for previous versions of SQL Server, if you're bringing in and consolidating SQL Server 2000, 2005 versions, you can use Hyper-V replica and have that asynchronously replicate at the VHDX level.
Yeah.
Into remote sites, and all managed by Azure as a service. So Azure, the data doesn't actually go to Azure. Azure just does the recovery part of it. You set recovery plans to it, automates the process of moving that data across and recovering in case there was a failure.
Yeah, and look, I'm going to give another angle on this, is that since the proliferation of HA at the host level, standard single instance VMs has obviously gone crazy. There's loads of them all over the place because they're going to pop up another place if there's a hardware issue. If it was really easy to do VM clustering, it becomes another conversation. Yeah. It's kind of like, why wouldn't I turn application layer availability on as well? Because I've got another level of protection, for one. Equally, I've got a more seamless transition between a failure to reconnection. You know, it's much quicker for a SQL cluster to fail over than for a server instance to reboot on another node. And the other thing about a server instance rebooting on another node, it's not crash consistent. Now, that VM died for some reason. If it was in the middle of doing something, it's gone. You've got a little bit more protection at the application layer, and even more when you're using availability groups, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have proper consistency around rollback and redo and undo basis.
So, and we're going to go into some of these things in a bit more detail. So from a VM configuration perspective, in fact, Shashank, were you...
Since we're talking about SQL environment here. So once the infrastructure layer, the fabric's been put into place, the VMs that SQL Server actually run on, we recommend running it on a Windows Server Core environment. Anybody running Windows Server Core in their... That's great.
Did anybody run it in 2008 or 2008 R2? Yeah, you were brave, weren't you? Yeah. In fact, you definitely get a prize for doing that.
In 2012, go.
Where am I going? You carry on.
All right, you go ahead and give it out. So with 2012 and 2012 R2, we can now enable that Windows Server Core. You can actually install in full GUI mode, and with the PowerShell script, you can actually now just go into three modes, from minimum to, what's the one in between?
Min shell, and then server with the GUI. Yep, and full.
So they're the option. So you don't have to change your standard operating environment to deploy. You can continue to deploy as you do right now, and then strip away the other bits. Now, this has some couple of impacts. It has performance improvement impacts, so it actually lowers the amount of memory SQL, the Windows Server VM requires to start up on. So in fact, when I was doing some builds, and when I tried to build in my laptop environment, where obviously memory is premium, I got only 32 gigs to deal with in a laptop, Windows Server Core allows me to stack a lot more VMs in there, because each VM takes only about 500 megs, as opposed to a gig default if you go with full GUI mode. The other thing it does is reduces surface area of attack, right? From a security perspective, we all love SQL for this. No security patches for the last 5 years, right? Well, what a great job the SQL team does. But let down by our brethren here. Oh. Windows Server OS constantly requires patching, and SQL gets down because of that. But
so the rich patch ecosystem that we have available to us ensures that we get those application updates delivered. I mentioned cluster-aware updating before, critical to make sure we keep patched. I'll make a quick comment about Core, is that Core is great in as much as it doesn't have the binaries for those other features involved at all, just the ones you've installed. Doesn't have any GUI on it, lower attack and patch surface, of course. When we talk about Hyper-V, though, you can use Core to enable Hyper-V. You should use Hyper-V Server, not Windows Server with Hyper-V, Hyper-V Server, because that's specifically customized. You can't even install the binaries. There's no way of getting them on there. The most secure and safe way, and can be managed just like a Windows Server.
This is right at the parent, the root level.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely, great. Other things to be aware of, NUMA support is up all the way up into the virtual machine level. So NUMA, which is non-uniform memory access, allowing you to have access local to the bus, local to the processor, and memory access is fastest when we enable that. Absolutely, we can enable that at the guest VM level. So for those multi-core, multi-CPU installations, leverage that, it absolutely has impact on performance. SQL memory, SQL's been doing this for a long, long time, dynamic memory management. And finally, the Hyper-V guys can also work with that. And SQL and Hypervisor work absolutely great with dynamic
memory. No prizes for you today.
No. He's not going to like me after this session. But one of the things we actually found out through this whole process, with dynamic memory, it actually defaults from, you say, a minimum start level, so you guarantee, of, you know, say, 512 megs to the guest VM. But we actually can, when you say dynamic memory, it can actually go up all the way up to terabyte. And that's one of the things with Windows Server 2012 is.
And that did cause us some fun, didn't it?
That did cause us some fun when we were trying to create some VMs through Azure Portal, because Azure Portal was trying to deploy out dynamic memory, and we had quota set at a much lower thing, lower limit. And when we tried to deploy it, we'd get errors back saying, well, you can't because you're trying to deploy
it. You haven't paid for it, right?
Yeah, so you haven't paid for it.
You can't do that.
So
it's just something to bear in mind, but it's manageable via the Azure pack, and we'll go into that, so that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. From a storage perspective, absolutely, VHDX is the new format that is supported in Windows Server 2012 onwards. We use that. Fixed versus dynamic doesn't matter. I mean, we used to say fixed was the way to go for SQL environments. But the way improvements have been made by the operating system, we don't see any sort of performance impact. In fact, the flexibility that you get, and again, the ability to stack more, store more, consolidate more, it's all goodness from that perspective.
And the brackets for me is very important, not pass through. You know, in the past, and whether it's our hypervisor or others, there's been people passing disks, bare raw disks effectively through into a virtual machine. And that is a very cumbersome way of doing things, and it doesn't give you any benefit anymore against VHDX at all. It's only going to give you more of a headache from a management perspective. And if you think about trying to be in a sort of a really self-service management world, the last thing you want to be doing is getting involved with that sort of stuff. You want to be leveraging VHDXs, running on SMB file shares if you can, because it's the ultimate flexibility that you get there. So that's a good point, guest storage and so on.
And the last one quickly I'm going to mention here, as we are still at the nut and bolts level, and I know we want to get it back into the Azure pack level, leverage SRIOV. This is the same sort of capability that we introduced with SLAT and hardware level translation for memory addressing. This is the ability for guest machines to be able to go out to your NIC and use functions of your NIC and minimize the hardware-level abstraction. So remember, this goes back to the fact that the reason why we used to say not to virtualize SQL Server, or in fact any database, was it abstracted CPU, memory, and I/O. These are three big things that any database, relational database engine was using. Now with SLAT, with SRIOV, we can actually minimize that. And in performance studies, and I've got links to ESG study that we've done, so now we can see about only 5 to 8% overhead that cluster hypervisor puts on top of SQL Server. So the impact is minimal, but the manageability automation that you get is great. Yes. Great question, and we're just about to get into the resource governor and showcase that. But this is more from it could control that as well, because then remember, when you consolidate your environment, you're going to have multiple SQL virtual machines running in this host where you want to make sure you have enough bandwidth allocated to this environment to have SQL traffic be able to manage correctly. So there's also the bandwidth management capability that we have.
Yep.
But resource governance is at CPU, memory, and I/O level. And if you're using for I/O, the scale-out file server, we're going to actually show you some interesting demos.
So let's move on so we can show you. I'll just point out these two pieces here, virtual hardware sharing SMB3, because on the next slide, where we get to talk about SQL clustering, I want to pick that up. Now, top level, SQL Server HDDR. This infrastructure guy is going to talk to you about it, and he's going to have to chip in and put me in the right place, probably. HA with guest clustering. Antifinity we talked about, right? But I would advocate that you use HA guest clustering. The reason I'd advocate that is because we're making it so easy. Okay? There is no blocker anymore. You don't need to be block attaching or iSCSI or fiber channel attaching storage. You can just use SMB. There is one other thing you can do, and this isn't going to be out for you guys. It's in preview now, but it's not going to be out for you until the 18th of October. something called shared VHDX. So you mount a VHD to a virtual machine. You spin up another virtual machine. That virtual machine can't talk to the VHD on that other one, can it? So that's what this capability does. You turn that on, and it becomes a shared VHD that two VMs can use. So it's another level of simplicity to enable this capability. It's creating a mini SAN, effectively. Yeah. It's a really nice little feature. And you know, Ben Armstrong, who is one of our hypervisor architects, who you saw at the keynote, I mean, he's predicting that that is going to change the face of the way that we actually see VMs deployed, because there will be such a low barrier to entry around deployment of clusters. Yes, sir. Yeah, so what we're doing is effectively, even if a VM's on a different host, all right, the VMs could be spread across all sorts of different hosts. You've got one VM over here, one VM over here. There's a common shared storage piece, the cluster shared volume under the hood, and there's a VHD sat on that. Both VMs can see it. We're basically turning on read-write to that VM for both SQL servers. So ultimately, what happens as far as SQL is concerned in there is that that disk, that D drive, is a clusterable volume that you can use for clustering and is available for you to stick your databases on and so on. So there's no load balancing so much as it's only in use by one VM at any one time, and then if you have a failover scenario, it flips over and clustering manages that for you in Windows. Okay, HA was always on, Shash? Yes, yeah, sorry. So it depends which piece is failing over. Yeah. If the SQL instance fails over because of some issue with the actual instance that's running and it has to fail over and run on a different node, then clearly there's a restart. If a file server restarts, and this is using SMB, so not the question over there, nothing to do with the shared VHD. Using SMB, if a file server node fails and the SQL server, you saw the path, the database file, that James MDF LDF that we saw, that is transparent. Server client SMB3, that's completely transparent to your database. It doesn't restart, it just continues working. Okay? Yep. Cool. Now, so HADR, I think we covered for always on and so on. The last piece on here around SQL clustering, you should know that if you're leveraging Hyper-V under the hood, you're not limited at all as to what you can do with SQL clustering. There is no, you can't vMotion it. There's no, you can't live migrate it. There's no, you can't have more than two nodes. There's no difference at all. Everything is exactly the same as if it's a standalone VM. So, and that's the same for SQL features. Everything's the same there. And Shash, you mentioned the Hyper-V recovery pieces earlier on for the guys. If there's any question on Hyper-V replica, we can pick that one up.
So let's see some of this under
the hood. Definitely. So I'm going to have to re-log in. If you could do the changeover for me, Shash.
Absolutely.
Okay. So changing gear slightly. Let's have a look at, under the hood, what's some of the components we have to build to manage this environment.
You've got the wrong machine.
Not that one. okay, so this is Virtual Machine Manager. And Virtual Machine Manager, you can see on the left-hand side, is pointing at my hosts in my environment and giving me some top-level stats on what's going on. You can see host performance here. And you can see memory, CPU, disk, and network throughput there. What I wanted to show you is, you know, whilst we can see our VMs and we can work on our VMs as we need to, what about deployment? So if I pivot across to the library here, one of the things you can see in the library is a list of virtual machine templates. VM templates are great. You know, it's not like it's a new technology. But VM templates that are as rich as this are pretty cool. So let me just open up this SQL 2012 on Windows Server 2012 R2 preview template here. And if I have a look, yes, you've got hardware configuration, and you've got 16 procs, 64 gig of memory here. You know, it's a big VM that's been configured. Just one disk at this stage, because it's going to leverage SMB, of course. OS configuration, all the details we need. You can add roles and features in if you wanted to add in, you know, .NET or something like that, or IIS. Any of those things, you can get that to be installed on the fly, join domain, so on. But then let's move to SQL Server configuration. Let me just skip application for a second. SQL Server configuration. And I didn't save this last time, but what you can see here is we've got a SQL Server profile attached. So the VHD that is part of this template that's going to get deployed onto a Hyper-V host has baked into it a sysprepped SQL Server. And I think you're going to talk about that a little bit in a little while. That sysprepped server then takes this configuration set of settings here. deployment, instance name, instance ID, run as account, the configuration, who's the SQL Server administrators that you want, what authentication type, those sorts of things, and service accounts, and applies that to that instance. So it configures it. So at this point, you've got an empty configured database. Now you go that next level. In the application configuration piece, we're able to choose an application profile. Now I've got one here, MyAppDB. How do you create a an application profile, and what is it? If you look at it, it's a SQL data tier application. It's a DAC pack.
A DAC pack, yep.
How do we get a DAC pack, Shash?
Come on, I showed you this earlier, Management Studio.
Okay, Management Studio, got my James database, which is on the SMB file share. Right click, tasks, extract, export data tier application, and then basically choose the file share to dump it on. So I'd actually just dump it onto the library share for Virtual Machine Manager, and it would appear for me to pick from in that list once that had refreshed.
So that's just an XML representation of the database as well as the data. It can be the data
as well. So that's the tables and all that good stuff. So fundamentally, we can create a template here, which we can offer out through our plans, which, you know, chicken and egg, we'll get there, we'll tell you about those. We can offer in our plans that is completely pre-configured end-to-end with our not only SQL configurations, VM configurations, but also the actual database itself. So that's a quick run through of VMM. The last thing I'm going to do before I jump out of here is just quickly pivot across into another component of System Center called Operations Manager. Now, if anybody's seen our management packs or our monitoring tool sets, this is a very basic piece of technology at this piece here, where I'm just showing you a feed in from my VMs of what's going on inside them. Okay? But I can quickly see, from a disk perspective, this is my SQL VM, what's gone on in the last little while. So, you know, last night when there was that CPU spike, there was obviously a disk spike at the same time, so we've got that information in there as well. But equally, what if I look at all performance data here, and this is within the SQL management pack, what I'm seeing here is even more, let me just, items in the chart list up, I've got things about lock timeouts listed here, lock waits, receive IOs a second, and transactions per second all listed in here. And this is coming out of the actual SQL databases themselves. So this is something that you get through that management pack capability. Cool. So let's just quickly close on the System Center piece. Are we back? Yep. So Virtual Machine Manager I went through. You've got that fabric config, the VM management piece, the ability to carve that out and offer it up. Then you've got the dynamic optimization piece, which I didn't cover, but that is the bit where you effectively are enabling the move around of those VMs based upon what we see from Operations Manager. The performance, SQL transaction per second go really, really high, move that onto an empty host node, for example, those sorts of things. The other components in here, I'm not going to go into detail. There's plenty of sessions this week and recorded sessions that you can watch on App Controller, Service Manager, Orchestrator, the monitoring pieces, and Data Protection Manager, which is a great integrated backup technology for SQL that you should definitely look at.
Basically, okay. From my mind, it's been System Center looks after the environment, looks after the SQL, what's happening. It helps me deploy and automate that capability. So it just puts things at peace of mind, and I don't have to worry about what's happening down below.
Absolutely.
And now I can feed my infrastructure guy some more Luxa. So while he goes off and has his Luxa,
I'll give you the clicker. You go.
We'll talk about some of the things that are coming in SQL Server 2014 that can help in a private cloud, hybrid cloud deployment. So one of the things that James mentioned in the template is that we can put in sysprepped images of SQL Server. Anybody using sysprepped images for deployments? A couple of people, great. More of you should be using it because it helps you automate and the implementation. You don't need to be sitting there with the CD clicking next, next, next every time you need to deploy SQL Server. Some of the announcements we talk about, SQL 2014, but we've also backported them to SQL Server 2012. I will talk about what we've done with buffer pool extensions, the ability to leverage, and we're starting to understand the hardware markets going through with devices like the Fusion I/O card, where solid state drives are becoming a lot more accessible, a lot more cheaper. So why not start leveraging them for SQL Server? We brought in online operations. So again, in the cloud environment, you want to minimize downtime. You want to have the ability to have your cloud environments available to your customers, to your business units all the time. So one of the things we've enhanced here, and one that's been requested for a long, long time, is the ability to have rebuild partitions online. So that's coming. IO resource governance, which I'm going to go into a demo of, and there's a great question around that. From a hybrid cloud perspective, we have the ability now from Management Studio itself to deploy an existing SQL Server database that's managed through SQL Server 2014 Management Studio. You simply right-click, launch a visit, and it'll take, you just put it, give it your certificate out to an Azure cloud, your Azure subscription, and you can go through and put that into either an Azure-managed virtual machine environment or the SQL PaaS, the platform as a service offering with Windows Azure SQL database. Other things that we've done is integration with the Windows Azure storage. So this is kind of a shift in how we can deploy SQL Server databases, because you can keep your compute on-premise, but your storage on Azure. So the ability to have your MDF, LDF files out in the public cloud and your data actual processing happens locally. Why would you consider doing this? Well, you probably wouldn't consider doing this right now when the data center's out in Singapore. Latency is a bit too high. But we are bringing data centers in Sydney and Melbourne, which allow you to have, you know, dark fiber connection into them. Latency doesn't become so much of an issue. But storage, it can significantly change your cost structure around storage. Storage is pay as you go in an Azure world. In your on-premise world, you have to buy new SANs, buy new storage racks, and the number of disks, and so on and so forth, every time you need to add incremental.
So that would be good for your data warehouse pieces, the bigger databases that you want to put out there.
Potentially, from a storage perspective, and do all the compute locally, and also from a encryption, management of encryption, management of security, that's all done on-premise. You know, so you don't have to worry about putting, when I talked about my crown jewels going into the cloud, you can truly still have that true hybrid implementation. Then ability to back up to Azure, and we're bringing in a cloud backup agent with SQL Server 2014, where we don't even have to worry about how often do we run backups, whether we run nightly full backups or every alternate weekend we run differential backups and transactional log backups every 5 minutes or whatever. We simply say, we need to meet this particular SLA from a backup restore perspective, and the agent will, in the background, be smart enough to do backups either to the cloud. Again, saving you from a storage perspective, cost around having those backed up. So SysPrep, as I mentioned, some of the enhancements that we've done is the ability to now have all services being able to be SysPrep. So previously, only database engine and reporting services engine was supported as SysPrep, but now we can do all of the services and also failover clustering. We have also backported this in SQL Server 2012 cumulative update, Service Pack 1's cumulative update 2 as a capability. I talked about that buffer pool extension, the ability to use SSDs. It's simply an alter server configuration statement, and you give it how big a buffer pool size do you want to use on your solid drive environment. And it's now going to keep those clean pages, so not the dirty pages that are in flight at the moment from a SQL perspective, from a transaction perspective. It's going to put the ones that have already were going to be about to flush into disk onto solid state drive. So it's still accessible very, very fast through solid state drive. We can free up some of the memory for more of the other in-flight transaction data. So a great, great feature here. So let's move on to the other feature that I was going to quickly talk about, which was resource governor. Yes. Well, essentially the agent will take care of that. Well, we're not deprecating maintenance plans or anything like that. That's still there, but it will be an addition to at this stage. And then, yeah, that's right.
I'm not going to throw. I will deliver.
Absolutely. So let's have a look at Resource Governor. Who's using Resource Governor at the moment? I guess you are.
It'll convert.
Yeah, absolutely. From a SQL perspective, that all you're seeing is that file group location is now an Azure Storage blob location, right? It's an ASV location that and then everything else from a manageability perspective, SQL engine itself. So that's the storage engine, but everything else from a management perspective, it's as you do. So again, SQL Server will have keep track of the transactional sequence numbers as we do on-premise. Think about it, it's just like a scale-out file server, but it's residing in the cloud. All right, similar sort of concept,
Shashank,
so we don't need to
I think we're
going
to have to move to rehearsal number 3 speed.
Oh, okay.
We have 10, 15 minutes.
We have 10, 15 minutes.
So
all right.
If you can know that fast, that would be fantastic.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to go through and create resource group pools, and obviously we'll take questions after as well, so apologize for this. So resource pool, being able to create those same sort of syntax as SQL Server 2012. I've created two pools here, so customer one and customer two, so in my private cloud environment, and then created a function here, which is what defines which pool they get assigned to, which workload group they get assigned to. So I've got one called, based on the database name, it'll go through and assign it to the right place. Then we go through and enable that, or specify that resource, that classifier to that resource governor pools, and set the defaults. So in this, the defaults are essentially saying minimum IOPS is 0 and maximum IOPS is the maximum limit there. So essentially this is default, no governance being enforced. So let's start my workload here. So customer one, customer two, got workload going, and you can see they're all competing for the resources equally. Now let's say customer one decides to put in more workload and, you know, he ups the ante and or has a busy period on their website and we start getting more workload coming through. So let me just stop and start again. We'll start seeing what's happened is the noisy neighbor story here where, you know, see customer one, even though he's paying the same plan or on the same payment plan as customer two, he's getting access to more resources. Now, it's not fair. So one of the things we can do here, set a minimum IOPS for the second pool so they get guaranteed level. So we basically alter that resource governor workload group and say minimum IOPS is 700. So let's see how that affects.
You're getting a leveling out there, aren't you?
So we're starting to get a leveling out.
Yep.
And then we go through. We can also set the maximum IOPS. So let's say if we're customer two finishes, we can go through and stop that. Now customer one, all of a sudden, again, has had access to everything. So, you know, again, not fair. So we can go through and put up a top level, top ceiling level as well. So we can say he's only allowed to go up to 600.
Yep.
Now, when I start the other one, it'll go through.
So you've got some pretty good granular control there, haven't you?
Absolutely. So it's.
What's just happened, Shash?
Those infrastructure boys. Jeez. So you're telling me you can resource govern at your level as well?
I can resource govern at my level. All right. I can completely resource govern off the screen.
you're number 5.
There we go. We'll come back. Here we go. So what I just did then was I just pressed apply on a setting that's in Hyper-V on a per VHD basis. So you can see here we've got quality of service management for VHDs. So I just put on maximum 200 IOPS just to be a bit of fun there. But what's important is just like you're doing that minimum IOPS so that you've got no noisy neighbor issues inside the database instance, inside the SQL instance, what about giving you a guaranteed minimum IOPS against other VMs that are on there as well for your SQL databases? So that's another thing that you can enable at the infrastructure level. It's a pretty useful little feature that you've got access to. Cool. So, changing gear. We need to show you a bit about this Windows Azure Pack stuff, right? We better show you how we did what we did. I'm not going to go through this, just to represent this is what we're now talking about. We're going to be talking about what this stuff is and really how we do this, and we're going to do it pretty damn quickly. You've got these concepts of service consumers and service providers. Obviously, a consumer wants self-service, capacity on demand, all those sorts of good things, predictable costs, getting up and running quickly. The providers want to lower cost, make more money. They want hardware efficiency. They want automation and so on. That's what they need. So how do we make that offer? How do they make that work and what are the offerings we have? As mentioned before, these are the offerings that are going to be available. We're focusing on the right-hand two here and what we're actually demoing and showing you guys. So let's just pivot back across, and I'll show you the demo of Windows Azure Pack Admin. So we were logged in before, and this is the login portal for the tenant experience on Windows Azure Pack, not Windows Azure. And there's another experience that you have, and it's called the Service Management Admin space. So it looks very similar, but this is the service provider side, the thing you don't see for public cloud for Windows Azure, right? This is the piece where I can go through, configure website clouds, VM clouds, and if I have a quick look at VM clouds here, you can see I've got these four clouds, and on those, they've got these virtual machines running.
So these are the clouds you defined in Virtual Machine Manager.
Yeah, absolutely. They're bubbling through. Then you've got Service Bus clouds, SQL servers, and Shash is going to go through that in a minute. MySQL servers, automation, which is key. It's an orchestration capability that we're building in there and is available in Azure. Then you've got the plans and the user accounts. So what we're going to do extremely quickly, is we're going to go new, quick create user. We're going to go for shash@crawshank.com. We're going to go password. And we're going to choose a base plan to start this person off.
Give me the all works plan, man.
The all services one,
the
right?
The all services one.
I'll give you the all services one. Bear with me 1 second. I'm waiting for that to press. Come on. Let me press create. There we go. And then you've got a user appear. That's not Active Directory. That's our own directory. You can enable ADFS and Federation to link the two together, single sign-on. Absolutely, you can and should enable that capability. The next thing you do, you now got that user, is that you go into plans. We may want to author a plan. So we can go new, create a plan. This is one of our offerings, I suppose, you think about it as. And we go for Shash TE plan. Choose virtual machine clouds in this particular instance. Go next, click tick. So that's been added to that user. So if I go now and look at Shash TE, sorry, that's been added. It's not been added to any users yet. I've got virtual machines clouds here, and it's not activated. So I can quickly go into virtual machine clouds. I can choose the VMM server, and you can have up to 5 VMM servers behind the scenes. Each VMM server supports up to 500 hosts and 25,000 VMs, so it depends on the scale that you're looking at. Virtual machine cloud, I'll choose one in here. I'm going to go for SuperCloud.
So again, this by defining the gold, silver, bronze, that's how you've defined which scale-out file servers were assigned to these clouds as well, right?
That's absolutely right. Then as I go down, I have to give access to certain resources. So I'll add networks. I'll add public, for example. As a network I can give access to. Now, you can obviously add networks yourself afterwards. And this is a different. These are the different selections of VM sizes I'm going to give to this person, this plan. And then the last thing is templates. And you can see the SQL Server templates that we've got in there we add in. And then some granularity around additional settings, checkpointing, and so on you might want to offer to the plan user. OK, so that's great. Now, if I have a look at our user again down here, our user doesn't have access to that. So Shash here, I can go, OK, let's add a subscription. Let's choose to add the new plan that we created called Shash TE. Excuse me for 1 second. And then we go Service Management Admin. And let's just go into here and press Submit. OK. So once we're logged in, what we're able to do okay. Once we're logged in, what we're able to do is see that plan that we've allocated. And I've had to go into a different one because I obviously typed the password in incorrectly. I've got virtual machines, networks, and SQL Server databases. So that was going to be our next piece to add the SQL Server databases in. But you can see how we've offered the different plan to the user. In the SQL Server databases piece, there's a pre-created database. In the virtual machines piece, there's a VM that's been spun up and deployed there. And you now have access to actually do those deployments from this piece. So Shash, from our perspective, and we were originally going to add that plan in, but given time and the fact that I can't log into that user, because I didn't type the password in right. One of the things we should have a look at, I guess, is from your side of things, you know, what happens when you add those SQL databases in?
Yeah, so basically you've got the infrastructure layout for SQL Server. So you've got, so in my case, I'd created a goal level cluster, which was a two-node cluster with always-on analytic groups set up with a disaster recovery environment, so another third node for that. Then I had a silver level cluster, which was just a two-node cluster, and a bronze level offering, which was a SQL Server 2012 Service Pack 1 running on a standalone environment for dev and test sort of workloads. And so those were the three servers that I'd registered back in the SQL Server environment here. And you can actually see those three different environments, the bronze, SQL Server, instance 02, instance 01 for gold cluster. And once I've gone through and registered those, I can actually specify how much capacity on each of those do I want to give. So, you know, how many user databases are you allowed to go off and create? And how many, and what's the total size of those? So you get to provide quota on these service plans. And you can actually also monitor who's been going off and which user's been going off creating these databases in this environment. And so this is how you go through and control in the service management portal in the admin site which offerings you can provide. And these offerings now get tied in with the plan that James showed you earlier. And that is assigned to the each and individual different user. So when I logged in my first initial demo, I could see the production, the gold, silver, and bronze. Yes, question? Yeah, absolutely. So there's a limit that you can specify as a per user limit and an entire limit as well. So
that. Cool. So look, there's plenty more that we wanted to show you in that space. I think what we probably are best off doing is just giving you a bit of visibility to, you know, what this is under the hood, as far as it's Windows Server 2012, it's SQL 2012 SP1, the back end for the Windows Azure portal. It's IIS, you need that for the website, obviously, .NET 3.5, and it's all installed through the web platform installer, which is a freely downloadable piece of technology. 18th of October is the day, and that's the link. 18th of October is the general availability of Server 2012 R2 and System Center R2, as well as the Windows Azure Pack R2. So that's when that technology is going to be available. And the demo that we're doing is on preview code at this moment in time. I think we're pretty much coming to the wrap-up environment, so wrap-up time. So what I was thinking is we'll pivot across back into the actual demo environment. And if there's any questions, we have a...
lovely Arc mouse.
Lovely Arc mouse, and well, we have hundreds of these USB pens that you'll feel free to sort of come and have a look. So, go ahead, sir.
Right, it's refreshing to see the infrastructure guy working so well with the super guy.
Give a hug on that note.
Thank you very much. I feel something coming here. What's going on?
But.
What's going on? Yeah. Okay.
It makes it easy to do the patching upgrades and all those sorts of things, and you don't have to line up 30 customers to get them out of the back, so to speak.
Yep.
Longstanding DBA says, well, I think I'll have all the databases in a single instance on a big virtual physical machine.
Yep.
Where's the middle ground? Now, is that white paper giving him up to say, you read this, and come to the agreement?
Okay. White paper, fantastic for all the infrastructural decisions around how you build stuff. Windows Azure Pack should be something you give to this guy and say, from an infrastructure perspective, this is the sort of thing you need to be heading towards. Otherwise, we're off to Azure, we're off to Amazon. We're going to go and do that stuff. You know, you're not providing me with that flexibility. The next point I would say is that physical SQL cluster you build, you can register that in here. You can register that in here so that is then offered through that Azure Pack front end. We can add a 2005 database.
Yeah, so absolutely. We can add a 2005 environment in this as well, right? So the 2012 is an absolute requirement from the infrastructure level for the private cloud. But for your applications, if they still need to run on 2003, SQL 2005, you can bring that as a P2V sort of conversion of physical to virtual into this private cloud environment. And guess what? You can register that. So to register the SQL environments, essentially you go new SQL Server, you can create a specific group or connect to that SQL Server environment, and you have it registered.
Did you
provide the capacity level and so on and so forth?
So the VMs themselves can be anything that Hyper-V supports. The databases can be previous generation of SQL database that you want to add in.
Of course, move off SQL Server 2000, that's out of support. We all know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi there, Hayden. Can I come find you afterwards to answer that question? The reason I say is that time's up, and we'd just like to say thank you very much, everybody.
Oh, please come up and
we'll
get
come
your
and talk to you.
USB keys as well. Thank